Good morning, everyone. I am honored to be here and to represent the American College of Surgeons Health Policy Research Institute. Some of you may know that that's a new group of researchers. We're based at the Shepp Center for Health Services Research, which has a pretty long history of doing rural health research and also workforce analysis. I want to acknowledge my colleagues, since I was neither the lead on this project nor the workhorse. Dr. Tom Ricketts, who some of you probably know from other rural health research, was the lead on this project. And then we had a med student, Amelia, who's currently in Africa, or she would have loved to have come. And then Elizabeth Walker, a new research associate with us, who did a lot of the work on this study. So today I'm going to talk about one of the studies that we've done recently, which was a survey looking at the migration patterns of rural surgeons, looking at reasons for their move and who moved. A little bit of background on this topic. As Dr. Myers mentioned, this has become a pretty hot topic lately, particularly for general surgery. Some analysis that we've done previously show that the ratio of general surgeons to population has steadily decreased in both rural and urban areas since the 1980s. We examined AMA physician master file data between 1981 and 2006, and we noticed that 34% of rural counties actually experienced a decline in the number of general surgeons per 100,000 people. We also have additional concerns that more communities are at risk of losing their surgeons for a number of reasons, but two of the main reasons that we're concerned is the age of the rural surgeon workforce. We do see a lot of rural surgeons in the older age bracket without many surgeons coming up in the pipeline to replace them. Additionally, there's been a growing trend among general surgeons to subspecialize, to either go on and get additional fellowship training and do a subspecialty, either transplant surgery or some other subspecialization, or to just simply narrow the scope of practice that they actually perform and focus on particular organs, and therefore not be sort of in the cadre of folks who are really offering general surgery. And my boss, actually, Tom Ricketts, has done some work looking at physician migration patterns, but there really hasn't been much work focusing on surgeons, and we know that the issues for surgeons are slightly different than for primary care for a few reasons. One, the technology that surgeons need in terms of supplying their operating room, as well as the staff that they need to support their services, it's a little bit different than for primary care. It's not very easy to just hang a shingle and start a rural general surgery practice. Additionally, we know that the call schedule is very challenging for rural general surgeons, and this is a major impediment to keeping staff in rural places. And historically, we know that there have been many fewer incentives for general surgeons and for surgeons to practice in rural areas than there have been for primary care. So the purpose of our study was to analyze characteristics of the surgeons who have moved to and from rural areas, and to better understand the factors that motivate surgeons to move to and from these places, and in doing so, identify some opportunities for new policies or strengthening policies and programs to retain or attract rural general surgeons in rural places. So our approach was to use the AMA physician master file to identify surgeons who had a move between 2006 and 2009. And the way that we did that was to look at the, for all of the physicians who had a specialty that we consider surgery, to look at their primary practice location in both 2006 and 2009. And if they had, if their primary practice location zip code was in a place that had a, which was considered rural by the OMB's 2006 CBSA definition in 1 year but not the other, then we retained them to sample them. And we invited all of those surgeons who met the eligibility criteria to participate in a 15-minute web-based survey. And of course, recognizing that some folks may not be comfortable doing a web-based survey, we offered the availability of a telephone survey or a paper survey. But the survey was designed to identify key factors in their decision to move, to find out practice characteristics in their former and in their new practice, including the number of hours per day on average they worked, the number of days per week that they were on call, their ownership status in the practice, and the volume of scope of their procedures. We also asked them about recruitment incentives and about questions in general about their experience practicing in a rural area. We, through the AMA Physician Master File, identified about 2,100 surgeons who, fit the criteria for participation in our study. And the majority of those folks, 55%, were people who moved from rural to an urban place. Sorry, did I skip one? Okay. The 2,100 surgeons who are eligible, we broke them up into the two groups, the folks who moved to rural areas or from rural areas, and the characteristics weren't dramatically different, but we did notice that the folks who moved from rural areas were more likely to be female, they were more likely to be under 40 years old than the people who moved away from rural areas, and that the people who moved to rural areas were slightly more likely to be international medical graduates. With regard to the actual move, there were very minor differences. On average, folks moved about 450 miles. They tended to stay within the same census region, but only about 20% moved to an adjacent county. Of the 2,100 people that we identified as eligible, we had 119 people respond, which, of course, we were disappointed with. It was a very low response rate, and I can get into some of the reasons for that. But all the same, we felt good that we got some interesting responses and information that could be useful. The population of folks who responded to the survey were actually fairly similar to the larger population of eligible. They were just slightly older, and females and general surgeons were overrepresented among our respondents, and IMGs were underrepresented. It's also important to note that general surgeons did make up about two-thirds of the folks who responded to our survey. So, keeping those facts in mind, we've asked folks to describe some of the changes in their practice characteristics from their prior to their current practice location. And we found that the folks who moved from rural to urban places tended to shift from a solo practice to either a hospital-based or locum tenens arrangement. They did have a small drop in the number of work hours, but a dramatic drop in the number of call days that they had, with an increase in surgical volume. Whereas the people who moved from urban areas to rural areas tended to stay in solo practice, but they did have a small drop in work hours and very little change in the number of call days per week. Not surprisingly, they had a minimal drop in call, in volume of procedures. We asked them to identify on a list of 15 different factors what some of the reasons for their move were, and to rank those 15 factors. We also allowed them to write in any additional reasons, and we found that there was some similarity among the two groups. Number one, of course, being quality of life was the lead factor for both groups. Now, of course, that means different things for people who are moving to an urban place or to a rural place, but we found it kind of interesting that that was the top reason cited by both groups. For people who moved to urban places, they also noted, not surprisingly, that work schedule was a major, major factor. Either the call schedule was very difficult for them to maintain in a rural place, or that they needed some relief so that they could take vacation and have some time off. Also, their perception about the quality of care they were able to provide seemed to be a major factor for folks who move from rural to urban places. Of course, income and then adequacy of support services, meaning the additional kinds of health professionals that they were practicing with. For the people who moved to rural areas, behind quality of life, income was one of the major reasons that they decided to move. And that may have as much to do with the cost of living in rural areas relative to their income as it does, just their actual salary. Again, the quality of the care that they felt they were able to provide was a major factor. And then shedding some administrative hassles that they perceived in an urban practice was a significant issue, as well as limited scope of practice and work schedule. We asked folks to identify any incentives that they were offered in their move and found some interesting results. The folks who moved to rural areas in the far right column seemed to be motivated primarily by financial incentives, whether a bonus payment or tail coverage or some other kind of financial arrangement like an income guarantee or moving expenses. Those tended to be the primary motivating factors for people moving to rural areas in terms of incentives offered. For the folks moving to urban areas, it really was more related to their practice, either a change in their call schedule or the offer of some sort of ability to purchase surgical equipment or you know, have some access to some sort of facility. We also asked the respondents to describe how satisfied they were with their move, and we asked questions, you know, about their satisfaction in their prior and then in their current practice. Overall, we found a very high satisfaction among both groups with their move. And with regard to their finances, both groups also said that they were better off financially after the move, but the people who moved to rural areas, surprisingly, indicated that they had a slightly higher high satisfaction reported. On a Likert scale, we asked folks to rate their quality of life before and after the move, and the change in the two scales was actually greater for the rural to urban movers. The last three items in terms of their satisfaction with their call schedule, procedure volume, and scope of practice, there really wasn't a significant difference between the two groups. So, what does this all mean? Probably, most of this isn't a big surprise to folks who know about rural surgical practice, but we did find it interesting that the recruitment of surgeons to rural areas does rely and seems most financial incentives seem most important. But retention is more complicated, and this is an important point, particularly given the changes in the last, 12 to 24 months with the 10% bonus payment for rural surgeons, as well as the addition of pediatric surgeons to the National Health Service Corps Loan Repayment Program. These incentives may be useful in getting physicians to rural places, but it may take a little more to keep them there. We observed that policies favoring or facilitating a favorable call schedule may provide the best opportunity to retain those surgeons, and that the quality of care that a surgeon perceives they're able to provide is another really important factor, and there may be some opportunities within that realm. So, as I mentioned, we have had a long-standing interest in rural health and now in rural surgery issues. So we are continuing to create new projects looking at issues as they emerge. A couple of the new projects that we're doing are, one, examining this anecdotal, what we have heard a lot of people tell us that there's been a shift from ownership for rural surgeons practicing in an ownership owning their own practice to being an employee of a hospital. So we are actually examining that question, as well as doing some case studies of what we consider innovative strategies for staffing rural surgical services. Tom Ricketts, who was very heavily involved in the development of primary care HPSAs, is now developing a proposal for creating surgical HPSAs, which will be useful in the 10% bonus payment for general surgeons. And I just want to point out our website, which I didn't put on here, I'm sorry. It's the American College of Surgeons Health Policy Research Institute. We've produced fact sheets and we have some peer-reviewed publications. We also have a really cool, dynamic surgery atlas, which shows total surgeons, general surgeons, and we're currently adding more bells and whistles, but it allows an interactive view of the ratio of surgeons to population in the U.S. and our website. I'd be happy to give it any of you the website on the side, but it's www.acshpri.org, and you can access all of the publications that we have so far on that website. And that's all.
Time for questions?
Sure.
It's perhaps a little presumptuous, but I'd like to challenge your conclusions.
Okay.
I think that your most important finding, well, first of all, the most important conclusion of all research is that more research is needed. This keeps us in business, but the finding that quality of life was at the top of the list for both the people migrating to and from rural areas obviously invites more research.
Right.
And it reminds us of how much is buried in language. In our own research, we found that the approach of end-of-life or end-of-life care has different meanings in urban and rural. So I would invite you, in your write-up and publication of this, actually put the quality of life, the quality of life is at the top of the list of those groups, at the very front of your conclusions, and just say that's what we really need to look at.
Good point. Thank you. Yes, ma'am. Yes.
I was curious about the financial incentive aspect of this. Is that, do I take that to mean that some entity in the community has offered incentives, maybe the hospital,
right,
or another group?
Mm-hmm.
But is there even financial incentives would be the thing I would expect them to offer? Are there other incentives they could have had that they didn't identify as important?
For example, what do you have something in mind?
Not specifically, but I have, I'm trying to remember now where I read it, that financial aspects were often not the thing that, that drove people to move into or out of rural areas. And so I'm reflecting on whether they were saying financial incentives because those were the only sort that could be offered by local entities.
Well, again, you know, there were bonus it depends on kind of what you consider a financial incentive. There were the straight bonus payments, but then there was additional things that we would consider a financial incentive, like offering tail coverage or a retirement benefit, something of that sort. So, you know, perhaps our question could have, well, we did offer people the ability to write in any, you know, other incentives they were offered, but the incentive, you know, as I mentioned, historically there haven't really been a lot of programs, informal programs to attract rural surgeons. So I don't know is the answer to your question. It could be.
Either you got one or you didn't get one. They did write in other incentives, and perhaps this would be the point, but it seemed to me that that was a relatively narrow way to describe it. And having said that, I admit I can't offhand think of others that might be offered.
Right. And again, I mean, these are incentives that were offered to them. It may not have been the driving, it may not have been the factor that really, you know, made their decision for them.
My question really goes very well with your comment on the quality of life, and that is that I'm assuming that your surgeons aren't only surgeons. I'm assuming that they're parents and spouses, and
right,
that the choices like this that
right
they make have huge implications for the other people in their lives.
Absolutely.
And so I'm wondering if you've had anything from your data where you heard that that might be an issue, you know, whether it's this is a great place to raise my kids or, oh my God, I got to get out of here because this, I can't have my kids go through the school system.
Yeah, and as we developed the survey, we really struggled with how to word these questions, recognizing that it was going to be a challenge to get folks to respond to the survey at all. We didn't want to have too many questions. There, we did identify whether people had families or if they were, if finding a career for a spouse was an issue, and we could probably compare, you know, use those two variables together to see if there's anything significant. Of course, keeping in mind that we only had 119 responses.
Follow up at another conference, one in rural health and retention providers, there was a point made of where they got their training and their roots.
Right.
And perhaps that's another variable to call for that, yes, they might have gone into an urban area if they really wanted to get back to where either they got their training or actually grew up.
And we did ask respondents whether or not they had any experience, whether during their training or if they had come from a rural place. I didn't present it in this study, but yeah, that is something that we will be analyzing as well. Yes.
I wondered, Dr. Sim, if the culture of self-reliance might be something that you could test in soliciting enthusiasm about your own
personalized health plan is like
this is not about your doctor telling you what to do. This is about you and what, you know, working with your doctor, because your doctor has important information and resources for you, but it's really about how do you take charge of your health and rely on yourself to really actually help. So I totally agree with you.
Yes, sir. In the back.
I have a question also for Dr.
Yes.
I was wondering if you know what percentage of your respondents have an identifiable medical home. First part. The second part is in envisioning personalized health planning, do you envision using other kinds of providers or staff besides physicians?
Yes.
Because I know in rural areas, and particularly in community health centers, we use community health workers in chronic disease management.
Yeah, so so as far as having a usual provider, among the insured patients, among the privately insured patients, about 90% of them had a usual provider that they saw. Among the publicly insured, so on Medicaid, about 85% of them had a usual provider that they saw. That significantly dropped, obviously, for the uninsured patients. So yes, I mean, so in thinking about healthcare reform and getting more people insured, I think our data would suggest that when people have access via some sort of insurance, they are identifying with a provider in most cases. So yes. And then to your second question, absolutely. So when we've done personalized health planning at Duke, you know, and it's really been around chronic disease management. So one of our studies was for secondary cardiac prevention. The other was for diabetes management. Really, the physician or PA was, or NP, depending on the study, was there to really relay what we found from the health risk assessment to say, you know, from sort of the medical standpoint, here are your risk factors based on the assessments that we did, you know, whatever tests we did, et cetera. Then they were transitioned to, you know, really, depending again on the study, a nurse or a health coach. Another professional who was part of the team, so who had that information, but then really worked to develop the plan with the patient. Because interestingly, what we learned is that the patients who were successful didn't care in a lot of cases about like what their, you know, hemoglobin A1C was, say, or what their, you know, that their blood pressure dropped 10 points. They really didn't care about that. What they cared about was, hey, you know what, I can go dancing with my wife now. I can take my grandkid on a stroll through the park and I'm not winded. You know, those were the things they cared about. They weren't really caring about those sort of traditional markers that, you know, physicians are looking at in terms of what, how they're gauging someone's health. So absolutely, I mean, it really is, you know, a team-based approach and really fits in well with the medical home approach, I think. Yeah.
Actually, just as for the general question about the rural communities,
yes,
project, how were states chosen, or were they, was it a volunteer sort of thing, or?
Yes, it was a volunteer. States were allowed to basically join the project. There was a core group of states who initiated it. This is through one of the USDA funding lines, and so basically through, can you speak more to the
chair?
Sure.
I'd be happy to.
The USDA has these separate entities that splits the country into regions, and so the North Central region developed a project, and then once it is authorized by the USDA to proceed, then a call goes out nationwide to the experiment stations or the different institutions across the country that this project is getting started, and everyone is invited. And so then, depending on whether or not you have someone at your institution who has expertise, interest, whether or not it's a priority at the state level, there's direct funding towards that, then, you know, that's sort of the mechanism to get people involved. And then you, every 5 years, you reauthorize. When you reauthorize, then the call goes out again, so new states can come in. So it's been kind of a fluid group. The data we presented here, those were the states that contributed.
Talk to me afterwards, because we now have Rural Families Speak About Health.
And we are at the stage of getting ready to collect data.
And Montana's not in the sample?
Yeah, well, and the other thing is, you know, 70-some% of our population are in eligible counties.
Okay.
I mean, like, it's a huge amount.
Yeah, we can visit.
I think maybe that's a good point to break it.